Good morning, world travelers and eaters and drinkers. Yes, you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, and happy Valentine's Day, 4 days ahead.
4 days, that's right.
Okay. 4 days, well, I think so.
I think it is.
14 less 10 equals 4, the last time I checked. Now, the question is, what color is that?
Yeah, that's true. That's another story.
That's a story for another day.
Valentine has to be red.
I see. So 14 minus 10 equals 4 is red.
Red.
And we have a special guest on the program.
But before
we go there, we should wish a very happy Sunday afternoon to our listeners in Europe. A hearty good day to friends down under. We'll be seeing you
in
just a few days.
So that'll
be fun.
Yeah.
Don't forget, you can track everything that On the Menu is up to at www.onthemenuradio.com. And now it's time to get down to the business of what you talk about and On the Menu on Valentine's Day. Anne, give us a clue.
Yes, well, we have a very special guest, Amy Riley, who has the answers to almost any question you would want that you would have about aphrodisiacs. She has gastronomy.
Do aphrodisiacs have something to do with Valentine's Day? How could
of
that
course.
Be?
Of course.
What's the connection, Amy?
Between aphrodisiacs and Valentine's Day?
Yeah.
Where did we get Valentine's Day?
Aphrodisiacs make every day Valentine's Day.
That's
very clever.
What are the origins of... let's just say you have this new book out called Fork Me, Spoon Me, the Sensual Cookbook, where you explore the wonderful world of aphrodisiacs. I should say to listeners that on the cover is a woman in the buff, on the floor with an open refrigerator, eating strawberries, is it, Amy?
Yes, she is. Yes.
And it's filled with wine bottles, right?
Oh, I think there were many things in there from vodka to Pellegrino, actually.
Uh-huh, okay.
But definitely a lot of champagne, yes.
Right. Now, is she you? Is that a picture of you?
No, that is not me.
You're blonde.
In fact, there are, it's funny, a lot of people will ask me that, even after they've met me. There are cartoons throughout the book, and I am actually the cartoon girl.
You mean you did them, or they are cartoons of you?
Yes, they are cartoons of me.
Uh-huh. So. And the cartoons I don't know, I mean, I guess, yeah, I can see the hair, maybe, not knowing you, not having seen you. Tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, Fork Me, Spoon Me actually highlights 12 ingredients that are foods that I like to talk about, because I like to highlight foods that have both rich folkloric history as an aphrodisiac, as well as some property that would make them aphrodisiac, some sort of physiological property. For example, chili peppers. Well, they raise your body temperature. Sometimes they'll bring a lovely flush to your cheeks. They'll make your lips sort of swell a little bit. Very seductive thing. And some of the other ingredients in the book, such as chocolate, I talk a little bit about, you know, the wonderful history that chocolate has as an aphrodisiac, and talk about realities.
You don't think it's as strong an aphrodisiac as, say, oysters, though, right?
Chocolate, unfortunately, no. It does have all those things that everyone talks about. It has the potential to give you that happy hormone rush and so forth. The trouble is, well, I once read a measurement. It was something like 28 pounds of chocolate you'd have to eat, really. because, you know, they say it'll give you actually an orgasmic rush, but I think it takes like 20-odd pounds of chocolate before you'd ever get there. And yeah.
How about oysters?
Yeah, it seems there are a number of people who've been practicing that I pass on the street who've been practicing eating 28 pounds of chocolate, but I think that they otherwise become somewhat unattractive.
Yes, it would be counterproductive to the romantic.
There you go. That's a thought. Huh?
But no, yeah. I mean, now, what's his name? The head of the Aztecs. What's his name?
Montezuma.
That was Montezuma who drank all the hot chocolate, right?
Yes, Montezuma was famous. Now, it was actually a mixture of chocolate and chili peppers, apparently.
Yes, the chili is...
Reputed to drink 50 cups every day before going and visiting all of his wives.
Yes, and then we have Casanova, who consumed all those oysters.
Yes. Casanova was also, he was fond of chocolate as well, and a few other items. But yes, oysters were definitely the ones with which he was most commonly linked.
And okay, so...
Oysters aren't one of the 12 ingredients that I highlight in Fort Meespoomy, simply because Fort Meespoomy is actually a cookbook, and a lot of people can't get a hold of good oysters. However, as you mentioned, they are historically, as well as nutritionally, an outstanding aphrodisiac.
Right. You also have a website. I think you ought to mention your website.
I would love to. It's called eatsomethingsexy.com.
Yeah. And what goes on that website?
Well, there are a number of contributors, and so there's everything from sort of romantic travel, recommendations of restaurants that are great for a date, and there's also a library of information on aphrodisiac ingredients. So a lot of my research is available on the site.
So this is serious academic research you're indulging in, Amy, correct?
I am, yes.
Oh, you are.
Yeah,
the book, it's very clear from the book that that's exactly what you're doing. I can tell that it's extraordinarily academic in its approach.
How did you end up with this as a specialty? You ended up going to La Varenne, I believe, to get this degree in gastronomy.
So, yeah, I went to Le Cordon Bleu a few years ago, started a master's program in gastronomy, and I was actually in the second class to graduate. So, yes, it really is. I'm considered a food historian, and I really am doing a great deal of academic research. I mean, it's obviously not what I am. I was more concentrating on double entendre, perhaps, with Fort Meespoomy. But I am, in fact, working on another book that is going to be a bit more of a serious research work.
Huh. Now, what would it be researching? Is it unrelated to this?
No, it would be much more of a dictionary of aphrodisiac foods, both historically as well as nutritionally and you know, different scientific evidence looking at different foods.
This dictionary and glossary format seems to be really popular now. We have the one about the Michael Ruhlman's Elements of Cooking. And we have, what's his name, who did the food lover, food snobs?
David Camp.
David Camp did one. It seems like people want reference books all of a sudden because there's so much going on.
Well, maybe it's because we're used to reading things on the web, which are in tiny little quick paragraph form. And,
right.
That's all we read anymore.
This is true, yeah.
Yes, so your book is, shall we say, word bites, or the word equivalent of sound bites. Easy to digest.
Yes. And in fact, actually, I find a lot of people say to me, well, I don't actually cook, but I keep Fort Meespoomy by my bed and read it at night.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, here's a recipe for a Persian love cake with candied rose petals. Now, that's very Iranian, but the whole focus on rose water and rose petals seems to be, by my standards, a coming trend.
I have seen a lot more rose water and rose petals. In fact, I recently had a very aphrodisiac cocktail. It was just a brut champagne cocktail with rose water. It was lovely.
Oh, wow. Where'd you have that?
I can't remember. I go an awful lot of places.
Oh,
you know, I file away the dishes that I love. I don't necessarily file away the experience.
Yeah, and you have no white peach Bellini. I imagine in moderation, all of these cocktails would be aphrodisiac, but too much of them and you're unable to perform.
Well, exactly. The book does address that topic as well.
Okay, so let's have some more of these ingredients now. You got listeners all excited, and so far we've only mentioned just a few. So give us some more of the dirty dozen, or whatever you might call them.
The dirty dozen. Well, as you just mentioned, peaches are one of them. And peaches, of course, we all know are full of antioxidants, so they're great for a lot of things. Figs as well, and I don't know if you have ever heard this, but a lot of people have a theory that the fig was the original forbidden fruit.
Right. Some people say pomegranate, and other people say fig.
Yes. So.
Yeah, we read that somewhere, but
apple seemed unlikely to me because it wasn't very sexy.
What tree did they get the leaves from?
They were fig leaves,
so at least we know there must have been figs in the garden.
There were definitely figs there, yeah.
There might not have been any apples.
So ginger, ginger is like a good all-around ingredient, isn't it?
Yes, ginger is brilliant because not only will it help raise your body temperature, but it also aids in digestion. You know, I really like to focus on foods that will also help make you feel sexy. You know, let's face it, I mean, fruits that have a lot of fiber, it helps, you know? Anything that's going to make you feel sexy and look sexy, as well as both turn you on, is always a great food to talk about.
What was the thought behind these illustrations, the cartoons?
Well, they were actually inspired by, there was a little cartoon girl who was a part of the original Playboy magazine. The art director on the book and I fell in love with the girl and those images. And we wanted to create something, not, you know, we weren't necessarily copying that, but we wanted to create something in the same spirit. Try to maybe conjure a slightly more romantic era, as well as something that was just playful and didn't necessarily feel like it was, you know, pigeonholed as a book of today. You know, something that kind of had... It's a fun, playful spirit, you know?
And lobster. Tell us about lobster.
Lobster. Well, lobster, of course, actually, you know, all seafood, of course, is quite aphrodisiac. And lobster being one of the ultimate luxuries of the sea. I mean, just as soon as you mention it, so as soon as someone says they're taking you out for lobster or they're cooking you lobster, there's just that little thrill. So lobster works as a terrific aphrodisiac. Plus, you know, it kind of melds well with a lot of the aphrodisiac ingredients, like champagne. I love lobster with a champagne sauce. In this case, it goes extremely well with vanilla. It takes on all of those very sexy, subtle aromas and flavors. So lobster is great to work with.
Yeah. Well, is there anything that we've missed that you'd like to recommend to our listeners so they're all ready for Valentine's Day or any day?
Oh, you know, I think that it's, you know, take the intention and take the time to enjoy the food and notice. Think about, plan ahead maybe the sensual textures of your food, the presentation of your food. Think about where you're going to serve it. You know, you don't necessarily have to... you know, you don't have to serve a seductive meal at the table. Do it in front of a fire. Make a picnic. Maybe not this time of year with the picnic, but, you know, certainly in front of the living room fire. There's nothing wrong with having a picnic in bed. That's one of my favorites.
Or you can always sit in front of the refrigerator.
Or you could do like Japanese.
Although, you know what? I got to tell you, it gets real cold in front of that fridge.
I'm sure it does. What were you doing on the back here? That's not you either. That's another model, right?
Yes.
And you have a lot of friends. We discovered you have an old friend called Robin Leach who's been a guest on the menu, and he seems to indulge in aphrodisiac quantities of various kinds of things.
Always seems
to have a pretty girl in tow.
Yes. Well, you know, Robin, I live part-time in Las Vegas, and we bump into each other around town, and I knew he'd have a perfect tawdry quote to add to the book.
So what was his tawdry quote?
Oh, you'll have to get the book.
We have it. I have it. I just don't know where it is. It'll delay.
It says here, if fulfilled pleasure comes from oysters or figs, this is the only cookbook and food novella that guarantees every meal having a very happy ending.
In fact, Robin once did a fork me spoon me dinner with recipes all. He once hosted a fork me spoon me dinner with recipes all from the book.
Did he really? In Vegas?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That's wonderful.
That's just the kind of thing that he'd be up to with a lascivious leer afterwards. A lascivious leer, there you go. There's a play on words.
Let's do some more repeat. This is on our website, right?
I don't know if I put it there yet because I think you were reading it the other day, so I didn't have a chance to put it up there.
Well, it has its own website, too, called forkmespoonme.com. Is that correct, Amy?
That's right, or you can find it through eatsomethingsexy.com as well.
Yes, which is the website, and I think that would be a playful thing to do for Valentine's Day, listeners.
Go
to the website and check out all the ramifications of this coming holiday.
But if you want to get it by the 14th, you better get it on Amazon.com, right? You better get on the menu radio.com, OTM Bookshelf, and get Amazon at work right away.
Yes.
And Amy, thank you.
Amy, thank you so much for being such a good sport and
well,
keep
thank
up the
you
good
for
work.
Having me.
Yeah, and enjoy your research.
Thanks. I will. I always do.
And, yes. And a very happy Valentine's Day to you and whatever friend you're spending it with. And now it's time to
take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station. www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're talking about all things sensuous for Valentine's Day. We have an old buddy on the phone, Rosario Sarfini, who is probably the first name in organic truffles, and we've tried many of his products and love them. Think he's clearly the leader in the truffle field here. And his latest product is a white truffle oil, olive oil, which has been highly praised, I understand. Welcome, Rosario.
Hello.
Yes, and it was highly praised in the New York Times most recently, wasn't it?
That's correct. We've launched the first USDA certified organic white truffle olive oil, black truffle olive oil, and porcini olive oil.
And the truffles and the porcini in this case come from where, Rosario?
What's important about the whole process is that these come from a cooperative farm in central Italy, in Umbria, and it's the only farm land in Italy that is USDA certified organic for truffles and mushrooms.
Now, why Umbria rather than Piemonte is the place that's perhaps most known for truffles, isn't it?
Piemonte is the most known for white truffles, but very few white truffles actually come from Piemonte, in particular Alba.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, Alba is sort of like the center, isn't it? Because we stayed there, and I guess they feature that a lot, but they're also very expensive there.
Yeah, because Alba is actually the market. A lot of people bring their white truffles.
Oh, I see. Okay.
To Alba for the market.
Now, the biggest market we encountered was in Le Marche.
Yes, Aquilania, actually. The Marche region produces the most white truffles.
I mean, they're crazy. I've never seen so many white truffles in my whole time.
We visited the wrong Senor Marini.
They all do truffles.
In Aquilania, there are two brothers called Marini. In Aquilania, you probably know them.
No, I know them. Yep, they've been around a long time.
Well, we were supposed to go see one of them. Mm-hmm. We had an appointment with him. We were expected and all that kind of stuff. And when we drove into town, we saw a sign for another Marini. We didn't even know it was another Marini.
It was just Marini.
We didn't know there were two. So we stopped at the one we saw the big sign for.
Right.
And it's down a little side street just out of the center of the town. And we arrived there. It was a little puzzling because it wasn't clear they were expecting us. But things are kind of vague anyway in that part of the world. The arrangement was set by somebody else on our behalf. So they welcomed us. We did eventually find someone who spoke a little bit of English. Senor Marini, this particular Senor Marini doesn't speak English at all. And what was going on was they were getting an absolute mass of orders via fax from the United States for truffles. So they didn't have a lot of time to talk to us. But when they eventually did, it was a lot of fun, and they had huge basketfuls of truffles, and it was clearly a big business. So when we were finished talking to Senor Marini, we said, where shall we go for lunch? And he said, well, there's this place just about three doors down the street. Mm-hmm. So we went there for lunch. Of course, it was the truffle season, so we had to have pappardelle with truffles, and we had goodness knows what else we didn't have with truffles. And then when it came time for the bill, they said, oh, no, Senor Marini has taken care of it already. So Senor Marini took care of us.
That was nice.
When we got back to the place we were staying, it turns out that this was not the Senor Marini we were supposed to be visiting. It was his brother, but they weren't on good terms.
Yeah, apparently they
were. You know, that happens a lot in the truffle business. There are three or four companies that are like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You mean they're related?
Yeah, there's Eugenio Brezzi. That truffle company is split up. It's two brothers that separated. There's canola. There's like four or five companies like that.
We're getting off track. Tell us what, was it Marion Burris in the New York Times?
Regarding which?
About your white truffle oil. What was?
Oh, that was a Florence Fabricant.
Oh, it was Florence Fabricant, right. Okay.
I know Florence for many years, and I thought it was a good idea to give her the exclusive. uh-huh. and I always respected her opinion, and she liked the product very much.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it wasn't in the article, but, you know, she said to me, Rosaria, now I know the real difference.
Well, you know, the thing I've always had a problem with truffle oil was it always tasted synthetic to me. And one of your things is that everybody puts all these chemicals into it. It's not real truffle oil.
Right. I mean, when you look at that stuff today, you know, I'll call it that stuff because legally you can't call it truffle oil. You know, all those labels that are out there do not comply with truth in labeling laws.
Right, because yours very carefully says white truffle flavored olive oil, correct?
Right. Well, it says olive, right. It's, you know, it's labeled correctly, you know. But ours has truffles in it. The other ones say white truffle olive oil would only be correct if, number one, there were real truffles in it, and number two, if the amount of truffles exceeded 51%, because the first word in your product label description is white truffles or truffles. And there's no such thing as truffle oil that's made with 51% truffles.
Well, it wouldn't be very oily, would it?
And it wouldn't be very oily to begin with.
Yeah, you
but
said
on top of that, it's compounded by not telling the truth in the label or in the ingredient statement.
Go ahead. Go ahead. No, please tell us the rest of the story.
So, and that has been going on for 30 years. You know, what I would say defrauding the American public.
Well, why doesn't somebody report them?
Nobody, that's a good question. Nobody actually did anything about it.
Uh-huh.
Some journalists from time to time would catch it and write articles about it. But since there was really no alternative, chefs either said, what the hell? You know, what's the big deal? You know, there's nothing out there that we can use to get this type of flavor. And number two, the American public does not know what truffles really taste like. So it was always pushed to them that this is what truffles are supposed to taste like. And everybody who's ever had truffles know that, number one, white truffles are not supposed to taste like, or black truffles are not supposed to taste like gasoline or diesel fuel or jet fuel. As I had some people say, you know what, sometimes when they're loading fuel on a jet airliner, when you get on the plane, sometimes you smell that. You get
that's
that whiff from the venting, and they'll say, it smells just like truffle oil. I said, that's why. I mean, it's a synthetic truffle oil flavoring. That artificial flavoring that goes into the oil to make that stuff is a synthetic compound, chemical compound that is similar to petroleum.
Oh, my.
Rosaria, you've been on the show before, and listeners probably didn't hear your interview. Refresh our memory as to how you got so involved with truffles.
I got started in the truffle business back in 1983. I used to be in advertising. Worked on several large mail order food accounts, Chevalier Coffee, Harry and David, Wisconsin Cheese Company, and in advertising, and in particular direct marketing, which I was working on, I saw how well our agency was doing selling all these products through the mail. I always liked cooking. I always liked food. I grew up around food. When I was a small kid, I used to eat my lunch when I came home from school in front of the TV watching The Galloping Gourmet.
Uh-huh.
I can't believe my liverwurst sandwich and my classic grape juice was, you know, red wine and pate. So I started selling Italian foods through the mail with the help of the advertising agency I was working with. And one of the items that was in my Italian food catalog was Orvani truffles. I met the owners that way through the catalog, selling their truffle products.
And they're the largest dealers in America, aren't they?
I don't know about today. When we were working with them, definitely.
I mean, they've
a
huge
lot has changed in the market since then.
At the fancy food show, they take up, you know, a considerable block of real estate.
Yeah, they still have those three booths put together, which is, you know, for a truffle company is very big. I know Sabatino also has a big booth too. But you know, I started with that in 1983. Started doing it full time in '84. And got into the truffle business, I would say, the long way. and I've been doing it ever since then.
Now, what's the difference between your email and your website now is called, is it Shop Da Rosario, right?
Yes, that's what we have is the original website was always Shop Da Rosario.
Oh, what? Something about forest, wild forest?
No, I'm not associated with that company any longer.
Oh, okay.
Or you can also just go to dalrosario.com, you know, www.dalrosario.com.
Okay.
And it brings you to, you know, all the information on the USDA certified organic truffle oil.
And it's D-A-R-O-S-A-R-I-O, listeners. And
right.
Tell me what my favorite product that you used to handle was a little jar of oil that had bits of truffles in it, black truffles.
Yes, and we'll have that back very soon, USDA certified organic. It's basically, it's, you know, it's like a carpaccio of white truffles or black truffles sliced in olive oil. And it will be 100% real truffles with 100% real truffle flavoring.
And you'll be getting these from the same place in Umbria?
Yes. We work exclusively with them. I work with the food scientists that created the natural flavoring, the organic flavoring.
Is that De Silvi?
Yes. And that is Silver Consulting.
Okay.
Sandro Silvieri.
Okay.
And just the whole process started back in 2002 when we said, you know, we have to come up with something natural that we could bring to the American people. Because I always said, you know, there's no such thing as fake caviar. There's no such thing as fake foie gras. Why should truffle products be fake?
In the case of caviar, I don't think you're entirely correct because there is a lot of very suspicious relabeling going on of.
When it comes down to what I always call real caviar,
yes,
the real caviar that's out there today is real. A lot of people in the past have spent time in jail for all the fraud that went on.
Right, right.
But that industry is all cleaned up.
Okay. So let me get the picture here. You are now rebuilding the inventory for your company. So you will have all these new products, and they will all be USDA certified organic.
That's correct.
What is on there now?
Right on there now is just the 8-ounce USDA certified organic truffle oils.
Okay. And the porcini oils.
As time goes on, and you know, in the end of February, we'll be introducing the smaller sizes on the oils. We'll be doing a USDA certified organic white truffle butter and black truffle butter.
Oh, no, Peter loves those, by the way. He makes mashed potatoes with those that we got from D'Artagnan. D'Artagnan stuff's real, isn't it? The truffle butter?
To call it truffle butter, and if you read the ingredients, it's important that if it says flavoring, then it's not the real stuff. I know their label says black truffles, soy sauce, truffle oil. I mean, just by the fact that one of the ingredients is truffle oil, where the flavoring is coming from, it's not real.
So they're taking something that's already a derivative. And mixing it in. It still makes really good mashed potatoes, I have to tell you that. What happened, it's not that we were being wasteful. We had two containers that we hadn't used very much of, and it was probably well beyond the...
I don't think that's wasteful.
Well beyond the use-by date, and as it turns out, Anne was in poor health at the time, so I had to try and feed her something. So I made her white truffle and then black truffle mashed potatoes, and she wolfed
right.
them down. So.
Yeah. But
just to give you an idea, like, you know, the truffle butters that are out there, the truffle oil. The truffle salt. A lot of those products all have that same synthetic chemical.
Now, what are you going to do? You're making truffle salt, too?
We're making truffle salt. We'll have it in about 6 weeks.
Okay, so you're going to have all this at the Fancy Food Show in New York.
Yeah, that's correct.
Now let's take a slightly different direction, because we've been working with you on another truffle connection.
Yes.
All the way across the world. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there. You're dealing with someone in the island state of Tasmania.
Right. Tasmania, which is a part of Australia.
Yep.
A good friend of mine for many years is Tim Terry, and his company has a very large tract of land where they're doing farming of truffles.
And what they do is they paint something onto the roots of a certain kind of tree. Is that basically
right? You know, people always think, "Oh, truffle farming. Are these truffles hanging off trees?" And it's no. What it is, it's an inoculation process. It's the saplings of broadleaf trees, either filbert or oak or poplar.
Oh.
And what they do is, it's basically they buy fresh truffles, they slice them, they dehydrate them, and they remove the spores from the truffles. It is mixed in a solution and under microscope It's like surgery, it's like microscopic surgery. They take the sapling and they inject the spores into the roots of the sapling trees.
Yeah, oh, wow. I read an article about this in Wine Enthusiast magazine recently. I think there's a place where you can sort of sponsor a truffle tree. And you pay.
Well, that's a good one.
You pay so much a year to rent your truffle tree,
and then you get to have the produce.
And then presumably, if it ever produces any truffle, then it pays off. It's probably a little bit like underwater land in Florida doing a
night trick.
And if you want to buy up on that, next thing I got a bridge for sale.
That's right. Right, didn't someone buy the London Bridge and was sent to Arizona or something like that?
No, you were saying also that the Oregon truffles are not legitimate truffles.
Well, the white truffle that comes from Oregon, Tuber gibbosum, is a true truffle. The black, quote-unquote, truffle from Oregon is not actually a truffle. It's a pecoa, Pecoa carfancisium. And that is not a true truffle because it actually grows above the ground. It'll start off life under the ground, as all mushrooms do, and then it eventually breaks the surface and grows above the ground.
Oh, that's so sort of cheating.
Yes, it's similar to another type of truffle, which is found in North Africa, and it was always quoted in biblical times, you know, my wheat fields for truffles, when in fact that is called a Trifetia leonis. It grows the same way as a pecoa grows. It starts off life under the ground, but as soon as it gets to within an inch, 2 inches, it pops up and grows on top of the ground.
Well, you are a treasure trove of information about truffles. I just like the way your products taste.
Our
products now taste good.
They do,
like they should, because they are real.
Well, they always did taste good. We loved the truffles suspended in olive oil that we had before. They were fabulous. And when we after we used those, I think we used the oil up as well.
Oh, good.
So anyhow, well, I look forward to your new products coming out and to seeing you when at the Fancy Food Show, and actually before that, when you're in Pittsburgh doing the Giant Eagle presentation.
Yes.
And hopefully they'll pick up your product, and that will make it easy for listeners at least around where we live to be able to get it.
And in the meantime, remember, go, listeners, to www.shopdarosario.com. DaroSario. Anyhow, allora. Grazie.
Grazie tanto e arrivederci.
And arrivederci.
Okay, thank you very much.
Ciao, Rosario.
And now
it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we have a guest, Dwayne Thompson, who has a wonderful story that goes along with a very exciting new product. Hi, Dwayne.
Hello, Ann. How are you?
Okay. We were just surprised that out of the blue, you noted that we were interested in new products, and you introduced us to your salsa. And your company is called Sabrosa, which is Spanish for flavorful taste. Okay. And we tried your salsa, and it's fresh, and it tastes just great.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, tell us just a little bit about how you ended up doing this.
Well, what ended up happening is the concept came to me when I was in college. And I started college in 1991, and I played football for Virginia State University. And what ended up happening is my grandmother had a produce garden that she used to send me produce on the weekends. And one particular weekend, she had sent up a few bell peppers, tomatoes, some onions, you know, just fresh produce out of the garden. And on that particular weekend, I had a late football practice. And my roommate, who did not play football, actually received those produce, and he ate it before I could get to it. So I didn't have a lot of produce by the time I got back in the room, and it was pretty late, and our cafeteria for the campus had closed for the evening. And I ended up pretty much making or putting together what was left of the produce. And That happened to have been a tomato, an onion, a green bell pepper, and an orange bell pepper that my grandmother had grown. And I just chopped it all up, put it into a hot plate, and I ended up making some salsa.
Right. Now, I mean, you had no other food experience than this.
At that time, no. I had not had any food experience at all, no.
But so how did you learn about adding balsamic vinegar and cilantro and fire roasting the peppers? Was this all part of the education of Duane?
It was all part of the education. Yeah. It's a funny story, because over the years, as I'm making salsa, you know, I began to become a salsa connoisseur, for lack of a better term. And I would buy salsas, and you know, I started tasting. I mean, it wasn't unreal for me probably to have about 20 or 30 jars of salsa in my dorm room during those years. So I knew what I did not like. And I knew what I wanted to have in my salsa, or what I wanted to have in a salsa. And I wanted to make sure that it was, you know, it was a healthy product, it was all natural, and there was no preservatives. And at that time, in the part of the world I was living in, most salsas had preservatives in them.
Well, now, I mean, how do you get this? What is the secret here for this very fresh-tasting salsa, and you don't need preservatives?
The secret, and it's not so much a secret, but it's the way that it's processed. We use fresh produce. We deal directly with the farms here in Virginia, and we have it. The bell peppers is a seasonal fruit product. I mean, it's a vegetable, but you know they call it a fruit. But once it's ready and it's at the peak of growing, we have them ship it to us, and what we do is we cook it, and we cook it at 190 degrees. For some strange reason, and I can't give you the reason behind it, but at 190 degrees, with that produce cooked, it releases that freshness taste. Everything kind of melds together and gives that taste. At 191 degrees, it tastes overcooked. And at 189 degrees, it tastes underdone.
That's bizarre.
Now, what do you mean by fire roasting? I mean, we buy a brand of canned tomatoes from, I think it's Muir Glen, which is fire roasted. Rick from Frontier Grill swears by it. So what's with the fire roasting?
Well, when we get our bell peppers, what we do is we take, like I said, they're pretty much picked fresh from the farm. I mean, they're probably no more than 3 days old picked from the time we receive them. But when we get them, what we do is we actually put them in the oven, and we roast those peppers until they are completely blackened.
Okay, all right, so that's the secret.
Completely roasted.
Okay. How did you bring this to market? I mean, did you find somebody already in the business that could do this product for you?
No, when I came out with that product, or as I was making it, it was pretty much just a family get together that I would make it for the family or make it for friends, and you know, a lot of friends would say, hey, you know, this stuff is great, you should market it.
Uh-huh.
So I started doing my legwork and research to see what it took to bring a product to market. And it was pretty in pretty detailed. So
it's not really, easy, is it?
I'm sorry?
It's not easy bringing a product to market with this.
Absolutely not.
And this is your only product, right?
Yeah. Our only product right there is that roasted bell pepper salsa. Mm-hmm.
And are you going to go on and introduce more products in the line?
Yes, we are. We're already working on two types of relishes that we're going to be coming out with, and we are looking at some other condiments, gourmet, all-natural condiments that we're probably also going to be coming out with in the probably early part of 2009.
Wow. Well, now's the time.
Yeah, well, this is a wonderful success story. And the right way to conclude this, of course, is to let our listeners know, because this is not a product that's in wide distribution. It's available in stores only in the immediate vicinity, I think, of where you live and work, Duane, in Southern Virginia.
Yeah, we're in Southern Virginia, and we are Kroger has just committed to putting the product into 15 stores, and it's going to be growing. We already have two deals in the works with two co-packers in Ohio and one in Las Vegas for our distribution there as well.
Great. And you can also buy online, so let's go with the website.
The website is www.sabrosa, S-A-B-R-O-S-A, foods, with a S, .com. So www.sabrosafood.com.
And you can order online, and then the only problem you'll have after your package has arrived is getting the lid off.
which is
exactly what On the Menu experienced. But I got to tell you, it took us every kind of lid removal tool that we had. It was worth the wait. Duane, this is an excellent product. We're delighted that you got in touch with us.
It really is so fresh. I'm just amazed.
Listeners, you just got to give yourself a treat. You just got to have some of this because I haven't tasted a pepper salsa that's anything even approaching this.
Yes, it's good stuff, Duane. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, I mean, the people like Chi Chi's who put their product on the store shelf should be ashamed.
Well, thank you very much.
So we thank you for reaching out to us, and we wish you continued success, and please keep On the Menu posted with all your new products.
You got it. I appreciate it.
Good luck, Duane.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
And now I guess we're going to
take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Continuing in our Valentine theme, we're turning to something that is for a long time now associated with Sweets for the Sweets Day, chocolate. On the line, we have Steve DeVries of DeVries Chocolate. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Ann.
First of all, I wanted to ask you, I have my own theories about it, but why all of a sudden is there more really good chocolate out there than, do you remember the days with Hershey Kisses and Whitman's samplers, and in Peter's case it would be what, rabbit?
Cadbury's milk chocolate, one of the most loathsome substances on the planet.
And now all of a sudden we have quantities of really fine chocolate. Why all of a sudden?
Well, why was it like that first? And that's because it got so industrialized over the last 100 years that it was just being made in big factories, and people didn't really think you could make chocolate in small factories. And then there were companies like Valrhona in France that started making smaller amounts and saying, we're going to make good chocolate, and we'll make as much of it as we can find the beans, and then we'll make any ore. And so that was kind of a different approach. And they had been working for quite a long time, but in the 90s started selling retail so that people other than chocolatiers could get it.
Uh-huh.
And then Scharfenberger in California started in the late 90s.
And they sold out.
And that's that was also a lower quantity and working more on quality.
But they're now owned by Hershey.
They were bought out by Hershey's about 2 years ago. And their volumes have gone up, and right now, really, volume and quality are inversely proportional. You can get very good beans, but not many of them.
Well, now, you're small, right?
Yes, very small.
Are you a boutique? Would you call it a boutique company?
Oh, boutique. That's a little too flowery for me. I mean, I have several ton pieces of machinery that are made out of granite and cast iron that's 100 years old. And
you were not always a chocolatier.
No, I worked at, actually I like to be called a chocolate maker.
You were not always this. You were a glass maker.
I worked in glass for about 30 years, starting out as a glass blower and doing gallery and public art, and then doing industrial glass, designer glass.
Well, now, this is not a straightforward transition. Not everyone who retires from making glass turns up making chocolate, so there must be a better explanation than that.
Yes, I was in Costa Rica doing an immersion in Spanish and looking for something to do on the weekends, and wanted to just take a tour of a cocoa plantation, and there wasn't one. In a country where virtually everything is connected with tourism, it was kind of strange. So I ended up taking a bus to the Caribbean coast and walking around the central market and asking people and getting sent to a little town and to ask for Mario Duarte. Knocked on his door, and he showed me my first cocoa tree and opened a pod and had a beer and talked about his cocoa plantation, and it was so inexpensive at that point that I bought about 20 kilos of cocoa beans just to bring back to my kitchen. I enjoy cooking, and thought it would be something interesting to do.
You were going to teach yourself how to make chocolate from the beans.
Well, it was more of a, here, this is, you know, this is strange, and I'm just kind of interested. And so what happened was I just roasted it in my oven.
Oh, gee.
Peeled it while I was, peeled the beans while I was watching TV, and I had an old grain grinder that I had from whole grain bread days in Boulder in the 70s, and ground chocolate, and that was really the point where the company started, because that chocolate, though gritty and not sophisticated, had a complexity of flavor. It just was amazing. Almost virtually my head was spinning, because I'd tasted lots of chocolates. I'd been to Europe and tasted their chocolates and recognized them to be better, but I'd never tasted a chocolate that had such a complexity of flavor and just amazing things. And so that's sort of that question of how can this be? There's these big companies with millions of dollars of investment in stainless steel factories, and here I am in my kitchen with $20 worth of equipment and no experience.
Now, where did you end up with this equipment? Why did you want the old equipment to start with, and where did you get it?
I ended up traveling around for several years on virtually every vacation chance I had, and saw quite a few factories. And there's were a number of them that I saw where they were producing their highest quality goods on their oldest equipment.
Huh.
And what that is about is that in about the last 100 years, I can't find a machine that says it makes better chocolate. They all say they make more chocolate, faster, cheaper, bigger quantities, but I can't find one that claims to make better chocolate. So that's, machines can do a lot of things, but they don't do things that you're not trying to make them do.
Now, it's curious, Steve, because I interviewed Clay Gordon, who wrote a book called Discover Chocolate, and I guess he has a website called Discover Chocolate, and he sure knows a lot about chocolate. You probably know him very well.
I do.
But he said people didn't start making chocolate the way we know it until certain industrial capabilities were in place. So you had to have a certain advance in machines for processing foodstuffs, I guess you would say, in order to be able to produce chocolate in the first place. He said the stuff that Montezuma reputedly drank 50 cups of probably wasn't anything like today's hot chocolate. It was probably rather bitter and gritty, and not something that you'd really be very interested in, and you wouldn't recognize it as chocolate. So some of industrialization has been important in making sure that you could produce the product in the first place.
Right.
In a way that has a lot of the impurities removed, I guess, and with enough processing to get it just right.
Well, we're probably adding more impurities now than would have been allowed in the late 1800s. But there was the Industrial Revolution hit chocolate in like 1890 or something like that. That's when Rudolf Lindt invented the
conch. Right, that's the guy, right.
Which was what made it first, the very smooth chocolate. And that's about the time, like 1892, when Hershey first got his machinery and all that started taking off. But that was, but that also has to do with the cacao that's being produced in Africa, because that gave them a cheap supply of cocoa beans.
And is it inferior, like, to what you're talking about in Central America?
The Forastero, which is basically a wild cacao that they brought out of the Amazon, doesn't have a lot of complexity of flavor. It has a very flat flavor, and it really only develops flavors in the roasting, whereas the flavor beans that are produced in South and Central America and Mexico, those beans have flavors, and those come from the beans that were domesticated and selectively bred over millennia by the Maya and probably Olmecs before them.
Okay, but this is just a very few percentage points of the world's total production of cocoa beans, right?
Well, actually, the figure is last year the bulk beans were 3.3 million tons.
Wow.
And the flavor beans were under 100,000 tons.
Wow.
So it's down, and it's down around 1 or 2 percentage points.
Right. And those are genetically favored beans, but a lot of those are so poorly processed these days that I wouldn't want to try to make chocolate out of them.
Right. Now you go back and you actually start with beans.
I start with the beans. I've been working with the same plantation in Costa Rica for 4 years now, and this April I'll be going down for my fifth year.
Do you get the beans green or?
Well, they come off of the trees. They're in kind of pods that look like acorn squash, more or less, but bright colors. And so those are taken off the trees, opened up, and the beans covered with they call it mucilaginous pulp, but that seems so kind of disgusting.
I mean, it doesn't sound very appetizing.
It's a soft pulp that's sweet and sort of citrusy.
Can you use that for anything?
And what?
Can you use that for anything?
Well, there are some people that use it for making some very powerful wines and liquors.
Oh, wow.
And
all deadly illegal.
Well, some of them are, but the reason for the sweet pulp is that's actually the plant's mechanism to induce an animal to open the pod, suck the sweet pulp off, and spit the seed out.
That's great.
Really the only way the tree will reproduce. And the alkaloid, the bitterness in there, to keep that animal from eating that seed, because it's nutritionally very dense.
Isn't nature smart?
It is. It's pretty amazing. And humans are the only ones who don't pay any attention and go ahead and reproduce it. But as a result, we've reproduced it around the world in a way that it never could have done by itself.
Now, when I asked if you get the seeds, the beans green, I mean, do you do your own roasting?
Yes, I do. I'm there when they come off the tree. And then once they're fermented in Costa Rica, it's 6 days. Then I take those sort of wet, smelly beans. They're kind of ammonia or vinegary. And I take them up to the Central Valley, and then we sun dry them over about 5 or 6 days. And
really?
I do a very slow sun drying that's similar to what I've seen on the north coast of Venezuela, where some of the best beans come from.
And then what? They come back here to your...
Yeah, they go into bags, and then they go in a container and come up here and sit in the back of my shop waiting to be roasted.
Now, you, in addition to manufacturing, I think we read you also just opened a storefront, too?
I don't have a storefront, but I am wholesaling to a few places here in town. Other than that, I just sell online.
Then I'm getting you confused with somebody else, Steve. I'm sorry about that.
Right. It's DeVriesChocolate.com.
That's DeVries.
Chocolate.com, singular.
What forms do you use? Now, I have the Nibs bar, and then the straight chocolate bar, which wasn't scored. That's the only one I've ever seen that's not scored. Is there a reason for that?
Well, I try to make them thin enough that they're fairly easily broken. So that you can take the size piece that you want.
Okay, you get exact measurement to your taste.
Right. I find some of the ones that are very thick bars, they force you to take whatever portion it is, and it's thin enough that most people can break it. I'm more concentrating on that chocolate rather than its appearance. Once I have the chocolate, I try to get it out in the sort of simplest form.
And what flavor profiles do you aim for?
I don't know that I'm really aiming for. I'm trying to, it's more a matter of discovery. What is there and what is possible? And that goes back to that experience in my kitchen with the ground chocolate was I was tasting a lot of different things. So I'm sort of looking at going all the way back to the harvest, what's being influenced, what flavor is influenced by the fermentation. And each year I do the drying a little bit differently. This last year I did a quite slow drying and was actually getting cocoa flavors developing in the beans before they were roasted. And I've never had beans like that. And I'm working on some pretty exciting chocolates right now.
And you're not tarting it up a bit. Nowadays it comes with exotic flavorings and spices and things.
My interpretation of that, and is that it's because the chocolate, the base chocolate, had gotten to be fairly boring.
Uh-huh.
And then again, that's chocolate that's made in huge quantities, and so the flavorings give you some sort of culinary excitement to the chocolate. But if a chocolate is a very interesting chocolate, you'd be unlikely to put flavorings in it. It's like a very nice Bordeaux wine, you know, you wouldn't want to put lavender in it or anything.
you wouldn't want to mix it with Coca-Cola, huh?
Right. Well, there are flavored wine, and I make the comparison with wine a lot, and I think it's very apt. There is a small proportion of the wine industry of flavored wines, but it's a small proportion because everyone recognizes that there are so many flavors available in just the grape and many different things possible. And that's what's exciting right now, is that different people are doing different things and sort of broadening what your expectations of chocolate are. If wine was like chocolate, there would be Chardonnays and white Bordeaux and maybe Cafe Zinfandels. and you would be shocked.
Well, let's do this, Steve, to wrap up here, because the program is rapidly drawing to a close.
Okay.
It's Valentine's Day in 4 days. So you have a chance to drive some business through DeRees Chocolates by telling them why your product is exactly what they should be giving to their lovey-dovey on the 14th of February. So go for it.
Aye.
That's too
boy,
hard a question.
Put me on the spot on
well,
that.
Well, yeah, we try.
I'm introducing a couple of new chocolates that are just coming out, and I think that my chocolate would be a chocolate that would give someone a surprise in a chocolate rather than being something that was the kind of sort of chocolate that they would remember from their childhood. It would be a new experience.
Does it have a name?
And
how do you identify it?
On the
website?
New chocolate?
Yeah.
The new chocolates that I'll be doing will be a Bolivian and a new release of a Costa Rican.
Oh, wow. Well, it's yummy stuff, Steve.
Yeah, we're absolutely delighted that you joined us today. You're helping us to end up our Valentine's Day show on a very sweet note.
Yes, indeed. It's actually not that sweet, which is why I like it.
No, yes. But sweetheart, I already got your chocolate for Valentine's Day because it came from Steve.
I see. All right.
Great.
Steve, keep us posted of any new developments.
Okay.
And thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you
and
so much
thank
for
you
joining
for
us.
The interview.
Sweetheart, I can't believe it. We're at the end of another show. I suspect that this show is probably one of our longest on record.
I think so.
Because we had so much to report. But
right. Here's
a happy Valentine's Day to you, my dear.
Well, thank you.
And,
isn't that sweet?
And may there be many more to come. And listeners, I should get a kiss at least for that, don't you think? And that's the end of the show for another week, and we'll see you same time, same place.
Next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.